And welcome to everyone. This is Lena Life. I'm Lena Mirmond, having very special guest today who is the author of incredibly fundamental approach towards heart life. His name is Dr. Nissen. And I would be very proper if I would say that he has a colleague and co-author of this book. His name is Dr. Mark Gilanoff. Originally, Dr. Gilanoff also was supposed to join us. His schedule did not permit so hopefully we will see him another time. But we are absolutely rejoined to have our guest today. And I like to start with one thought which I developed rereading this incredible book. We're all craving for returning to favorite places. And I must confess that the book Heart 411 became one of the centers of our busy lives, which we often return to. And I'm so glad that Dr. Nissen returned to us. And I welcome him with my initial question, how this book was created, taking into consideration a very harmonious union between physician and surgeon. I'd like to have your input and give us some sense what was the roots for this creation.
Well, it actually was Dr. Gilanoff's idea. You know, he's a very thoughtful surgeon. And when he came to me and he said, I think we should do a book for patients that have heart disease or at risk for heart disease, I thought about it and I said yes very quickly. Frankly, one of the reasons we developed the book is that we realized that there was so much misinformation out there on the internet that patients were reading. And frankly, a lot of what they get, which is misinformation, they get, for example, from network television. I'm not sure if you read the New Yorker article about Dr. Oz, but they point out that the vast majority of the advice that he gives is simply scientifically wrong. And knowing that, and knowing the public was getting bombarded by bad information, we thought it was important to do a book that was grounded in scientific fact, not opinion. And so we researched the book around what we could prove, not what we believed, but what we could prove. And that process, which went back and forth for over a year, led to the book as it currently exists.
You just almost read my mind, because one of the first points I wanted to make, that this overwhelming information on the internet and also, frankly, as you pointed out, some major doctors who are quite misleading make us patients extremely disoriented, very nervous, panicky, frankly.
It absolutely does. You know, people will come in and they will give us a list of all the dietary supplements that they're taking. Well, you know, people who are quite well educated actually believe that some of these dietary supplements like fish oil and vitamin D and these things that get promoted are actually beneficial to the heart. And when you look a little deeper, you realize that it's primarily scientific nonsense, and yet people are taking those therapies and not taking the therapies for which we have very good evidence of benefit.
You know, I heard even that, again, you see, I'm very careful. I don't say that I know. I would say I heard, because a lot of different rumors are filling our minds, and they're creating a lot of questions. And you just pinpoint one of the most sensitive ones is dietary supplements. And I would continue on my third point that some of the oils even not very safe to take, not only for the heart, but they are cancerogenic and they are very questionable in terms of the sources. Can you comment on this? If that is not good, then what is good?
I absolutely agree. And let me just tell you that a law was passed in the United States Congress in 1993, promoted by a corrupt U.S. senator whose family was involved in businesses that make dietary supplements, that bars the FDA. The FDA is not allowed to regulate dietary supplements. So that even when the FDA thinks that the supplements are dangerous, they are really kept from acting. It's a truly a national tragedy that we have all the expertise at the Food and Drug Administration, and what the Congress did was they put the power to regulate dietary supplements in the hands of the Federal Trade Commission, a group of people with no scientific expertise, and that has resulted in some serious safety concerns. So focusing on what works, our book talks about heart healthy diets, the use of medications in certain people where they're appropriate. It talks a lot about the benefits of exercise that we know and have very good evidence can reduce heart risk. We talk about stenting and surgery, and it's really a very frank discussion about those things that we have good information about where patients can be pretty certain about what's beneficial and what's not.
And add to this, you pointed very clearly in the beginning of the book, one of the beginning chapters, that unfiltered information, these are your very telling words, make one really to take a different look, to become much more aware and to get to the bottom and to the source of the information. And your book, not because you are my very favorite guest of the show, but because indeed your book Heart 411 does present three parts: scientific evidence, it does explain how it is indeed influencing a heart condition, and number three, it gives a person a choice, because it's not that you're just naming a few points, a few dietary supplements. You give a whole system, and you're providing very logical, transparent advice why and who should use a certain supplements.
That's right. You know, but the point about this is to empower patients. You know, there's no better advocate for your health than the patient themselves. And, you know, the old way of thinking in medicine was, you know, that the doctor would do all the thinking and the patient would simply follow the orders of their doctor. And I think that's changed. I think the access of the public to more information means that the public can be informed and the public has a right to make choices. And so, you know, what we say in the book sometimes is that there are more than one good choice. And here are the pros and here are the cons of those individual choices that you might want to make as a patient. And being empowered as a patient was one of the things that was really a serious goal of the book.
And I would add to this that this book certainly providing a guidance for heart survivors. I cannot not to mention very high convincing praise by well-known Larry King, who truly feels that your book is his heart guide. And his points are extremely convincing because he was a very deep heart patient with the surgeries. And also, this book extremely useful for people who are very conscious, and the people, like you just pointed out, decided to make very conscious, responsible choice to monitor their health and condition their heart. So this book is extremely useful and very adaptable to every body style of life. And also I found particularly golden connection to the whole health as a big picture with great descriptions of details. And if you permit me, I like to dig into a few specific points of your book and starting perhaps not necessarily consecutively, but some points which are so important. And one of them, I even remember the diagram. It is, I even remember the name of the number of the page. It's page 17, where you indeed making an example of the points which people need to be aware of. It's just a picture when you come to the cardiologist, you're filling up those usual papers. But there are certain points which I found unusual. For example, you making a point of rheumatoid arthritis. You certainly making emphasis on other health issues, which are not directly a heart problems, but they are connected. So could you kindly walk us through and give us some examples how alert we need to be making certain assumptions that if we have pain or problem in one hand, it can be indeed indication or some danger for the heart?
Well, it's actually very interesting. The story about rheumatoid arthritis and heart disease is quite a fascinating one. The rheumatoid arthritis patient has as much as a doubling of the risk of developing coronary heart disease risk. And the question has always been why. And if you look more deeply into this, what you will find is that those patients have an elevated level of inflammation in the body. And we now understand that it's more than just high cholesterol and more than just high blood pressure, but the presence of inflammation that drives the development of plaque buildup in the coronary arteries. And it's a great example where you have one disease, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, which can be very disabling, but even more troubling is it can actually increase your risk of coronary heart disease by producing this generalized systemic inflammation. So it's a very interesting story, and it's one we wanted to make sure people understood.
And a story indeed, extremely memorable. And this is only one of the stories which you put in a book, which makes book extremely friendly and very accessible, in addition to certainly quite intensely described medical conditions. I like to, again, welcome my listeners and tell them that I have exceptionally interesting information which has to do with a book, Heart 411, who was the book which was written by Dr. Steven Nissen and his colleague Mark Gilanov. I'd like very much to ask you about a little bit more specific questions. We did touch upon that last time. You explained the stress test necessity or lack of, again, really important information about this. But I'd like to ask you perhaps about some other testing, and let's divide it in a routine test and tests which might be necessary if there is a problem.
So your question, as I understand it, is, you know, what kind of routine testing should everybody have?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
What we say in there is that sometime when people get to be adults, sometime in their 20s, it's a good idea to have the cholesterol checked. Now, if it's If it's normal, you may not check it again for a few years, but it is a important thing to do. We also strongly recommend that people have their blood pressure checked frequently. But we are very careful not to recommend a lot of expensive, fancy, and particularly invasive tests that are frankly very commonly done in patients. For people that don't have chest pain and that are otherwise healthy, we don't recommend a treadmill test. We don't recommend calcium scans to look for calcium in the coronary arteries. We make the point very strongly that routine testing that goes beyond these simple preventive measures actually does more harm than good. So it is quite a conservative approach to testing, something that's being adopted not just in cardiology, but in a lot of areas. You may know that recently the federal government had a task force that recommended that men stop getting PSA tests, something we used to do in every man every year to look for prostate cancer, because the outcome of the test was actually making people worse, not better.
I like to dilute a little bit the seriousness of our conversation and tell a little joke which shows how patients can be somewhat under doctor's care, but only somewhat, cannot get through the care. It says that, I remember it says that my doctor is absolutely wonderful, and once I could not afford an operation, he touched up my electrocardiogram, meaning that because this patient could not have an operation, he would feel better if at least cosmetically his electrocardiogram will look better. And
that's a really interesting comment. It's a wonderful comment because we do a certain amount of that, and it's cosmetic. And, you know, what we need to do is to focus on those things that make people feel better or live longer. And that's not everything that we do. You know, we spend 17% of our gross national product on healthcare in America. That's twice what they spend in most European countries. It's too much. Much of that expenditure is wasted on tests, procedures, and even drugs that either don't work or are not effective in some way or another. And by telling people about those things for which we have evidence of benefit and those things about which we have no evidence of benefit, we hope that people will be more intelligent consumers.
And I'm glad that this comment came from you as a doctor of absolutely major clinic, Cleveland Clinic, and I talked in great details of your quite phenomenal credentials and history of the clinic in my first program. I do not want to repeat this now because I am very much value your time, and I like to move forward with some other questions. However, I like to ask you to comment on a certain philosophy and concept which you have at the Cleveland Clinic historically, and it is uniquely serving human needs and human desires.
Well, it is a different model at the Cleveland Clinic. And, you know, we were actually very pleased that, during the presidential election, during one of the debates, both President Obama and former Governor Mitt Romney commented on the Cleveland Clinic model because it is a different model. In most medicine in America is what you would call a traditional fee-for-service approach. You see a physician, the more the physician does to you, the more they are paid, and that creates an incentive to do more things to patients, more heart catheterizations, more bypass surgery, more stenting. and so on. What has the Cleveland Clinic has done over its entire history is said that that model is the wrong model. And so everybody in the Cleveland Clinic is salaried. We get the same salary at the end of the month, regardless of whether we do a lot of procedures or a few procedures to patients. And so the incentive is to make people healthy, not necessarily to do more things to people. And I do think it's a better way, and I think over time it's a system that will evolve around the country as a more common way of taking care of patients.
Well, I'm already your cyber patient. I hope I will stop this dimension. But just in case, I wanted to thank you for having contributed to this truly fantastic model. It's realistic. You have incredibly positive results. And frankly, when I had just very recently a conversation with one of my friends from Moscow, they said that this is something they like to remodel in Moscow, where a number of very excellent physicians, but a lack of funds for technical assistance there and equipment. But I just wanted to make sure that you know and that you should remember how proud you can be that this system in this very tough, stressful world is working in your clinic, and hopefully you will have more followers.
Well, we hope so. We hope it'll sweep the country, and people will, as they realize that, you know, creating a situation where there is the wrong incentives for physicians is not the best way to take care of patients.
And this is something which I would say almost unavoidable because of a very sharp realization of what is needed. And numbers and facts are screaming. So I just hope that that would be as contagious as anything positive human experience can permit. So I like to thank you that you made these points. You brought very brave points, and I like to move on to some of the points on the book, coming back to concrete medical statements and medical descriptions. I'd like to concentrate on one chapter where you're describing emotions and the heart. We obviously know that this very powerful abstract dimension as an emotion makes incredibly strong impact on the body, on the health, and heart becomes one of the focal point. And I wanted to ask you one question, which I meant to ask you last time, but I didn't have opportunity. If we talk about heart rate, and there is a known theory that you have to have your heart rate up to 80% ideally for 20, 25 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week, and that's somewhat semi-guaranteed that your heart will be well-trained. What if I substitute, not personally myself, but let's say a human goes through a certain experience, give a performance, give a speech, and his heart is pumping very, very strong and beats are very rapid. Is this the same heart exercise with a, let's say, treadmill exercise?
No, it is not. And it's a very good question. It's actually a question I've never been asked before. But it turns out that we now understand more about how exercise improves the heart performance. And it turns out that it's not just getting your heart rate up. And in fact, we make the point in the book that is not useful to get a heart rate monitor. So many of our patients want to ask us, well, I have a heart rate monitor. How high should I get my heart rate? How long should I keep it there? And there's really no evidence that there's any particular level at which benefit occurs. But it's not the heart rate that benefits the patients. It's the physical exertion that raises the heart rate that has the benefits. And what it does is it makes the muscles more efficient. It allows all the muscles in the arms and legs and everywhere else to do more work with less blood flow from the heart. And that effect we call conditioning. And so if you get your heart rate up, but you aren't actually doing so by using your muscles, it has no benefits, and in fact, it is probably harmful. In fact, if you want to make an animal's heart fail, you put in a pacemaker and you increase the heart rate, and over time, the heart will actually fail. So heart rate going up per se is not what's beneficial. It's the muscle activity that's beneficial.
This is absolutely extraordinary, and I do not want to take much of a time for my comment because unfortunately we're coming close to the end of the program. But what the clarification which you just made truly took very profound place in a number of my colleagues, because we are going through certain cycles and we simply finding an excuse and thinking that if we are active and if we are in a high top performance, we are not stagnated and that we are continue conditioning ourselves.
And actually, and you know, what's really interesting about it is that those kinds of emotional swings that take place of anxiety leading to increased heart rate and so on and so forth, there's lots and lots of evidence. And in fact, we even have patients where that's actually harmful. There's a disorder known as Takotsubo syndrome. It's a Japanese word in which people who get very anxious or worried actually develop something that looks an awful lot like a heart attack. And so that kind of stress and anxiety that raises the heart rate can have very adverse effects on heart health. It's not beneficial. It actually is probably harmful.
This is quite extraordinary. In fact, it is something which goes back to the literature time where 19th century philosophers and writers would share some of their style of life and most common description for creating something really personal was a very harmonious being in a park, taking a walk, perhaps feeding the dogs, or something which will indeed provoke this very natural muscle work which you talked about, and at the same time, it will be in the nature where everything is working, including the lungs and air taking. I wanted to jump to one point in the book. You mentioning the relationship between the heart work and pollution. If you can please comment on that.
Yes, and before I do, let me also echo what you just said, that, you know, go to Italy and go to the rural countryside in Italy, and after dinner, everybody's out after dinner walking in the streets. The whole town is out walking. And then look at the rates of obesity in Italy. And, you know, this is an issue, is that in America, you know, I have a neighbor that lives four houses down from me. And when he comes to visit, he drives his car. And, you know, it's this is what we do in America, and it's no wonder. It's no wonder that that we're not healthy because we've adopted these bad lifestyles. Now, I'm sorry, your follow-up question was what?
Let me follow up on your comments. In addition to driving, now we have a worse thing. We have a convenience of internet and cell phones. So why to see each other? Just text it. And that makes a great exercise for thumb, but not for the heart. I just couldn't help it to continue your comment.
Yeah, well, I agree. I agree with you completely. And so if there's one piece of advice I could give your listeners, if there's one thing to do, find a way to exercise every day. And I want to make one more important point about it is that the intensity of the exercise is not particularly important. Even just walking at a brisk pace will help tremendously. More is better, but any amount of exercise is better than sitting on a couch watching a television show and eating a bag of potato chips.
There are so many really fundamentally important secrets which you open in your book and clarified so many important issues. I being very brave to make a comment that just in case if your time will permit, we can continue this extraordinarily valuable conversation with you as an author, as a physician, as a thinker, and I would say as a philosopher. With that, I will come back to my smaller question, but who knows, maybe it is a big question. What I was asking about the pollution and the heart, there are very, very few people would make a connection between the heart life and issues and disease, and suddenly here is a pollution. Please comment on that.
Well, we know something about this. We're still not absolutely certain, but the evidence is accumulating, and we know that people that live in big cities seem to have more heart disease independent of other risk factors. I personally think that the largest contributor is probably carbon monoxide, which is in automobile exhaust. And it turns out that carbon monoxide, when you inhale it, damages the cells lining the blood vessels throughout the body and in the heart, known as endothelial cells. And when those cells are damaged by carbon monoxide, then they tend to allow cholesterol to accumulate in the walls of the artery, leading to the plaque buildup that we call atherosclerotic heart disease. And so if you look at people who are exposed in the course of their work or in the course of their daily lives to carbon monoxide. Now, if you go and walk on the streets of New York City in rush hour, there's a lot of carbon monoxide in the air, and that may, in fact, be one of the sources. In addition, there's some evidence that particulate matter, the kind of soot that comes out of the exhaust of cars, also seems to have some adverse effects on the heart. So it's not as solid as some of the things we know, but it's pretty good information, and you know, I think it's something people have to be aware of.
I regrettably have to say that our program is coming to the end, and I cannot imagine better ending as to just take some excerpt from your book and finish my program this way. At close to the end, as a conclusion, you are saying, we hope we have motivated you to begin making those changes in your life that will help you move in the right direction. You certainly did motivate us, and I have to tell you personally that this book, as I mentioned in the very beginning, became, I would say, a pleasure to read because it has so many points. I just scratched the surface, but one of the fascinating beginning you have referring to historic research, you're talking about Egyptian mummies and you leading your thought to modern times. It's just so fascinating and so educating. I wanted to thank you very, very much, with the hope that we can come back to you again, just as we're coming back to your book. And if you have any final thoughts with no question from myself, you're most warmly welcome to do so.
Well, I'll give you one final thought, and that is stay out of that deep snow in New York City that's coming.
Oh, you just made a wonderful point, and thank you for your wishes. I totally forgot, but I need to tell you, the last storm, Katrina, which definitely made a huge impact. Actually, I made a mistake. It's not the Katrina, it's Sandy. There are so many storms that these names are getting in the wrong order. But the last storm, Sandy, which was in November, was truly a very scary one. And your book, believe it or not, was extremely comforting pillow, because if someone had some obviously emergency, then there is no book will help you. You need an emergency room. But someone who already was acquainted with your book because of our program had a great information, and being aware of his or her heart condition could be prepared to be isolated from a medical point, from a medical service, and they truly learn a lot from your book. So your book is fantastic for everyday life, for emergencies, and for storms. So that's my last gratitude to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I wanted to say again thank you to all my listeners for joining us to this extremely relevant, valuable conversation with Dr. Stephen Nissen, who I would say a pioneer in many ways, because he brought a different vision and brought a very clear knowledge for what is right and for what is wrong. That was Lena Miermont. I am welcoming you to my next program. And until next time,